Today is Thursday, July 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump said he was sending additional federal officers to more U.S. cities.
This bloodshed must end. This bloodshed will end. Today I'm announcing a surge of federal law enforcement into American communities plagued by violent crime.
Plus, how the pandemic is affecting children.
I think the biggest change for a lot of children right now is the tremendous disruption in their daily life and their daily schedule.
And the Olympics are 1 year away again. Those stories and more are next. A group of 15 U.S. major city mayors is calling on the federal government to immediately withdraw federal forces and agree to no further unilateral deployments in U.S. cities. In a letter Tuesday to Attorney General William Barr and Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, the mayor said the federal government's decision to send officers into American cities is unprecedented and violates fundamental constitutional protections. VOA's White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara starts us off.
Black Lives Matter protests have continued in the U.S. since the death of George Floyd while in police custody in May. Most are peaceful, yet some are marked by looting and vandalism. President Donald Trump is cracking down with an aggressive federal policing campaign called Operation Legend.
This bloodshed must end. This bloodshed will end. Today I'm announcing a surge of federal law enforcement into American communities plagued by violent crime.
Trump is sending hundreds of federal agents to Chicago, Albuquerque, and other cities that he says need help to stop crime. While state officials have asked for the federal government's help to quell unrest in the past, this week, mayors of 15 cities, including Chicago, condemned what they call unilateral deployments by the administration. Lori Lightfoot is the Democratic mayor of Chicago.
Nameless agents riding around in vans, pulling people off the street, depriving them of their constitutional rights. That is not what a democracy looks like. And we are not going to have that in the city of Chicago.
Trump has sent federal agents to cities including Portland and Seattle, but they have not calmed tensions. Lori Woods is a sociology professor at Vanderbilt University with research focusing on law enforcement.
Going in and arresting a bunch of people and sending in the feds may give you a moment's peace, but it's not going to give you long-lasting peace.
Trump's federal policing effort is being challenged in court, but even if he loses, there may already be a political advantage.
The radical left-wing mob's agenda? Take over our cities, defund the police, pressure more towns to follow, and Joe Biden stands with them.
Biden has said he opposes defunding but does favor conditioning federal aid to police departments. Trump's campaign is pushing the narrative that the country is in chaos and needs a law and order candidate to win in November. Omar Wasso teaches race and ethnic politics at Princeton University.
People running for office will often use conflict, things like ethnic conflicts or inter-ethnic riots, as a way to stir up support for their side. And already we've seen something like that, where the Trump campaign is using footage from protests in places like Portland in their campaign advertisements.
Despite Trump rhetoric on the rise in violent crime across the country, FBI data show that many major cities have less crime than they did decades ago. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
Now to find out about the legality of these deployments, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Professor Andrew Crespo, who teaches criminal law and criminal procedure at the Harvard Law School in Massachusetts.
It is unusual for federal law enforcement officers to be taking the lead in keeping order in our cities. And that might seem strange around the world, but in the United States, it gives people some real pause to even see federal law enforcement officers out on the streets. It gives people particular pause to see federal law enforcement officers dressed in combat fatigues and really, to our eyes, indistinguishable from soldiers out on the streets of our cities. It's something we're not used to. We're used to having our local police departments and our state police be taking the lead in this situation. It's something we're really not used to seeing when our state governors and local mayors are saying, please don't come in here. to the federal agents, and the federal agents are there. I won't say it's unprecedented. There are certainly instances of federal law enforcement going into states where the states don't want them, but it's a dynamic that our federalist system really sort of makes these issues in really sort of stark relief.
So acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has come out pretty strongly on this issue. He said, quote, "I don't need invitations by the state mayors or state governors to do our job. We're going to do that whether they like us there or not," end quote. Is that legal?
We should understand that at least at face value, what he is saying as to the authority of federal law enforcement to even be in Portland has some merit to it, right? There is a federal courthouse in this city. It's federal property, and it's not just federal property. It's a key institution of the federal judicial system. It's the federal court in that city. And it's clearly been vandalized. It's not really that controversial here to say that the federal government can protect federal property or prosecute people who are vandalizing or attacking federal buildings. The question is, how far beyond that primary mission of protecting the federal courthouse are these essentially paramilitary officers going? Are they really there to protect the federal property, or are they using that as a toehold to try to essentially displace the local police, or at least, you know, do much more broad and sweeping law enforcement actions to address what the federal government clearly perceives to be lawlessness in Portland? And we get mixed messages from Secretary Wolf on that, because he certainly, you know, he knows that his legal authority is tied to protecting this courthouse. So he says that a lot. But then he also, you know, frequently speaks in these sweeping terms about, you know, lawlessness in Portland, talking about how, you know, how much damage there's been to the city. It's not his job to police the city. In fact, he has no authority to police the city. That's a tension that's a sort of a gray line in our law. How far does the primary mission that he has asserted of protecting federal property, how far does that stretch?
Andrew Crespo is a professor at the Harvard Law School, where he teaches criminal law and criminal procedure. He was speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. The mayor of the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, was tear-gassed by federal agents late Wednesday as he stood at a fence surrounding a U.S. courthouse during another night of protest against the presence of federal law enforcement sent to quell the unrest in the city. Speaking with protesters, Mayor Ted Wheeler said he's worried that the protesters' message fighting racial injustice is getting lost.
Nationally, we now have a reckoning. Nationally, we've awoken the systematic racism and the injustice and the massive inequities that exist for BIPOC communities nationally. And I'm worried that the Trump administration is changing the channel. And it's becoming about crowd control tactics.
Mayor Ted Wheeler, a Democrat, said it was the first time he'd ever been tear-gassed and appeared slightly dazed and coughed as he put on a pair of goggles someone handed to him and drank water.
He's a mayor.
Wheeler didn't leave his spot at the front and continued to face the gas. Around him, the protest raged, with demonstrators lighting a large fire in the space between the fence and the Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse, and the pop, pop, pop of federal agents deploying tear gas and stun grenades into the crowd. It wasn't immediately clear if the federal agents knew Wheeler was in the crowd when they used the tear gas. And coming up later in the program,
we are facing an unprecedented challenge again now because This postponement is the first ever postponement of Olympic Games in Olympic history.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Amber Heard will take to the witness box for what's expected to be the final day at the High Court in London during Johnny Depp's libel case against a British tabloid. On Wednesday, the actress alleged that ex-husband Depp threw 30 or so bottles at her as if they were grenades or bombs during a drunken and frenzied assault in Australia in March 2015. The late Nick Cordero is to have an album released in his honour. The Broadway actor spent more than 90 days in hospital fighting for his life after contracting coronavirus. Broadway Records said Wednesday it will release Nick Cordero, Live Your Life, on September 17th, what would have been his 42nd birthday. Clint Eastwood sued several companies that sell CBD supplements on Wednesday, alleging that they're falsely using his name and image to push products he would never agree to endorse. Two lawsuits include allegations that companies have spread phony articles reporting that the 90-year-old actor-director is quitting movies to focus on his CBD business. This is Lizzie Knight with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker counts 15.25 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus and nearly 625,000 deaths worldwide. The World Health Organization says about a third of those living in the Americas are at a higher risk of developing serious cases of COVID-19 because of underlying health conditions. The western U.S. state of California now has recorded more coronavirus cases than anywhere else in the country, and AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has that story.
This latest spike in the virus, with nearly 13,000 new cases reported in one day, means California has surpassed New York with over 415,000 infections, although California's fatality rate is four times lower at 8,000. Governor Gavin Newsom says the state is so much larger than most others, it's not all that surprising.
We've begun to reopen key sectors of our economy. People continue to mix.
He's announced a deal with a Chinese firm to buy more than 400 million medical masks. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti admits they might have been too quick to reopen some businesses.
It became kind of a domino effect with the, as I called it, irrational exuberance of everybody thinking we could rush back to normal.
Now bars and indoor dining are closed again in three dozen California counties. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The COVID-19 pandemic has caused an epic disruption in areas of life usually considered stable. Community life, work, and play, to say nothing of the formal and informal economies we depend on. However, for children, social isolation and lack of structure can feel especially destabilizing. For part one of our two-part series on the mental health challenges children face today and ways parents might help their kids, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with psychologist Clark Goldstein. He's a former clinical assistant professor in the child psychiatry department at New York University Medical Center and is now in private practice in New York. They began their conversation by speaking about the emotional disruption younger children face during the COVID-19 era.
I think the biggest change for a lot of children right now is the tremendous disruption in their daily life and their daily schedule. And with that comes a lack of routine, and for many children, a lack of socialization with their peers and their support groups.
Why is it structure per se that's so important in a young child's life?
I think having order both internally and externally is part of the maturation process and part of being able to become a functioning adult. But without it, it's harder to sometimes organize their thoughts and their growth and their education and just the interactions that people have in a school setting directly with teachers and peers and what we also call sometimes the hidden curriculum, the things that aren't explicitly taught in school.
I imagine there's a lot of loneliness and lack of socialization during this period.
I've seen some variability in that. So I have some families where, let's say they live in a cul-de-sac and they have their kids socially distanced outside and playing with kids. Those kids are often feeling less socially isolated than kids that are maybe only children that are at home and not seeing anyone. And because they're more isolated, there's often a feeling of loneliness, irritability, sometimes general dissatisfaction, and some of those kids are acting out more.
What can the parents of an only child do to compensate for the lack of peers for their children?
You know, the family is certainly not going to take the place fully of peers, but for the parents, when possible, to spend one-on-one quality time with the kid where they're talking, checking in, playing a game that the kid wants to play, not using it as a time to set demands, but just really having a time to allow growth in the parent-child interaction through that time together.
But what about when the kid is acting out, to use your term? When, for example, they suddenly get angry but don't really know why?
I think role modeling is tremendously important. Of course, this is a very stressful time for many adults, disruptions in their lives and disruptions in their work lives. A lot of families are going through financial stress. And being able to model calmness and an ability to tolerate dealing with uncertainty is a tremendous gift parents can give their children. Every parent wants their child to have a clear and great path. But what we know, right, is sometimes our growth comes from stressful situations. You know, we want to kind of soothe our kids, right? So a lot of times a kid might say, I'm worried about this. And the parent might say, don't worry about that. Or, hey, it's under control. Or, hey, the numbers are dropping. better strategy sometimes is to acknowledge and validate the fear and potentially correct in a way which is an and instead of a but. So just even the tone of saying, I hear you're being worried about COVID spreading or people that you love getting sick. And the good news is in our area, the numbers are seeming to go down. And for most people who get it, the survival rate is very, very high. So you're kind of giving accurate and factual information while also validating the fears of the child, as opposed to sort of contradicting them or telling them they shouldn't feel that way.
Is it okay for parents to tell their kids that they're a little scared too?
Yeah, I think normalizing emotion, I think, is a good thing, right? We don't want kids to feel shame or guilt about having emotion. For a child to hear that a parent is scared, I think is completely appropriate, you know, depending on how the parent does it. So if they, yeah, I'm kind of scared at times too, that I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. And I can understand you feeling scared too. So the gift parents can give to their children is to model dealing with stressful situations with calmness and a tolerance of uncertainty and being hopeful at the same time.
That was psychologist Clark Goldstein, former assistant professor of child psychiatry at New York University Medical Center. He was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. A UN program is calling for a guaranteed temporary basic income for nearly 3 billion of the world's poorest people to shield them from the worst impact of COVID-19. The proposal argues the financial aid would help slow the spread of the pandemic by enabling impoverished beneficiaries to stay home. Lisa Schlein takes things from here.
The United Nations Development Program says that 1 billion people live below the poverty line on $1.90 a day. Nearly 2 billion others live just above the poverty line, but are at risk of falling below. About 70% work in the informal sector. They are self-employed, unpaid, and not protected by any social insurance scheme. Despite COVID-19 lockdown measures, people who work in the informal sector are forced to leave their homes to eke out enough money to support themselves and their families. UN Development Fund chief economist and lead author of the report, George Gray Molina, tells VOA their prospects of weathering the current crisis without a guaranteed income are bleak.
What we'll see is quite horrific. It's, people with no jobs, no livelihoods, no income, with containment policies that are variable. Some are working, some are not working. If they don't work, then you see the spread of the virus it gets worse and worse. So it's a vicious cycle. And this can be part, we think, of breaking that vicious cycle.
The UNDP estimates $1.2 trillion would be needed to provide a temporary basic income for nearly 3 billion of the poorest people in 132 developing countries for 6 months. Molina notes this sum is nearly equivalent to the $1.3 trillion of what developing countries owe in external debt payments this year. He says one way that countries could pay for the temporary basic income, or TBI, would be to defer payment of their external debt for a year.
The Secretary General of the UN has called for a comprehensive debt standstill, which would include, all private creditors and also official bilateral creditors. So that's one source that we think could work. It's a standstill for 1 year, so you'd stop paying the banks for a year, but then you would restart paying the banks as soon as the TBI is over.
Several countries already have taken steps to introduce a temporary basic income. For example, UNDP reports Togo has distributed more than $19.5 million in monthly financial aid to nearly 13% of the population through its cash transfer program. Women who work in the informal sector are the main beneficiaries. It says Brazil and Colombia recently began registering people as a prelude to receiving financial aid. It adds that Spain recently approved a monthly budget of $289 million to supplement the incomes of 850,000 vulnerable families and 2.3 million individuals. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA has expanded coverage of the global pandemic on our website. A German court has convicted a 93-year-old former SS private of being an accessory to murder at the Stutthof concentration camp in Poland, where he served as a guard in the final months of World War II. DPA News reports that Bruno Day was given a 2-year suspended sentence by the Hamburg State Court. He was convicted of 5,232 counts of accessory to murder, equal to the number of people believed to have been killed at Stutthof during his service there in 1944 and 1945, and one count of accessory to attempted murder. Because he was only 17 and later 18 at the time of the alleged crimes, Day's case was heard in juvenile court. Britain said it can still reach an agreement with the European Union in September. That's from its chief negotiator, David Frost. He added that the latest round of talks on a future relationship between Britain and the EU ended with substantial areas of disagreement. The one-year countdown has begun to the 2021 Olympic Games, with a more muted affair than in the first attempt 12 months ago. On July 24th last year, a glitzy ceremony promised an unforgettable spectacle. And even 6 months ago, organizers were still bullish, determined for a return on their huge financial investment. But just 2 months later, plans that had been almost a decade in the making were shredded as a health crisis gripped the world. IOC President Thomas Bach.
We are facing an unprecedented challenge again now because this postponement is the first ever postponement of Olympic Games in Olympic history.
Coordinators say the 2021 Olympics will be simplified, reduced to must-have events. Over 200 measures will be reportedly needed to streamline that event. And how much that will cost Japan, well, it's anyone's guess. The Games have already cost over $12 billion before they were postponed. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. And on behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, or desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is proud of its long-standing partnership with the nations of Africa, based upon mutual interests, shared democratic values, and a decades-long commitment to improving the lives of the African people. Much of our cooperation deals with aid delivery. In partnership with more than 120 countries, the U.S. government is working to help defeat the COVID-19 pandemic. USAID takes the lead in this effort in tandem with the State Department, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Department of Defense, and others as part of an all-of-America response to support health systems, humanitarian assistance, and economic security and stabilization efforts. It's important to note that this assistance is aligned across the three key core objectives of the President's Africa Strategy, said Assistant Administrator for Africa, Chris Maloney.
The first objective being advancing trade and commercial ties with key African states to increase American and African prosperity. The second is protecting the United States from cross-border health and security threats. And the third is supporting African states' progress towards stability, citizen responsive governance, and also what we call the journey to self-reliance here at USAID.
It's important to flag that right now we find ourselves confronting COVID-19, he said.
And I'm excited to report that today we've committed close to $350 million to help countries across sub-Saharan Africa respond to the COVID-19 pandemic.
The tens of billions of dollars that the United States has invested over the past decades, particularly through PEPFAR and the President's Malaria Initiative, has created incredible trust-based relationships for us across Africa, said Assistant Administrator Maloney.
One thing that I think has been exciting is, for example, in South Africa, we've had the ability to leverage about 20,000 healthcare workers working traditionally on the PEPFAR platform, so the anti-AIDS platform, to now pivot to work on COVID.
This ability to leverage these platforms that we've been able to develop in a covered space has been very, very important in our response, said Assistant Administrator Maloney. I'm confident that our relationships and the shared experiences that we've had with our African partners over the past decades will continue to help us meet both today's COVID-19 crisis and the broader development issues at hand head on.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.